Hi, today is January 26, 2020. This is Mobius Podcast 315. I'm Todd Agassaward, my good friend John Westfall, and I'd like to thank our friends who joined us last week. I'm not even going to try alphabetical order. It was, let's see, who was with us last week? Frank McPherson and Chris Spira and...
Yep.
And, Oh, Don. Was it Don that joined us last week? No, it wasn't Don. Don had to drop out.
Don was, was not here.
Yeah. And we missed, I'm missing one person and I don't know why. But anyway, thanks to our friends who were able to join us last week. It was a lot of fun. And we're going to do that again sometime. So I'm going to start off with my Wi-Fi router adventure, actually two. So the Eero, E-E-R-O, mesh Wi-Fi access point / router was kind of on sale about 2 weeks ago. And so I ordered one, just one. I didn't order an actual mesh. I just wanted to play with the router because it claimed it had better coverage all by itself, even without a mesh. So it was like, I don't know, $90. So I ordered it. Came in. I could not get that thing to work. mostly because I didn't follow its, not instructions, but its recommendation to use a phone instead of a Wi-Fi device to set it up. And I didn't understand why it was suggesting a phone instead of just a Wi-Fi. I was going to set it up from an iPad, you know. Because, you know, most Wi-Fi routers, it has a local web server built into it. You connect directly to the Wi-Fi router itself. You set it up. It sets up the internet access, and you're off and running. Well, this thing requires you actually get a call from Eero, which is now owned by Amazon. And that's the internet. Mine got all screwed up. And to make matters more interesting, and I'm sure it's only a coincidence, my then current Wi-Fi router kind of went wonky on me. And by wonky, I meant it changed the default internal IP address, you know, within the house, from 192.168, which, you know, most people are pretty familiar with, to another Class C, or is it Class B, non-routable IP address at, you know, 10 dot. And I never used 10 dot in my house. I always used a 192.168 or something close to it. It's kind of
10 dot is Class A.
Yeah, and it's also non-routable, but which is so it's used in wide area networks for intranets and so forth. But at any rate, there I was. I had two non-functioning Wi-Fi. Basically, I had no Wi-Fi in my house. Well, let me rephrase that. I had Wi-Fi, but it was acting weird. And so Wednesday morning, I needed to work at home for a little bit before I went to an all-day training, and it died. So this was Tuesday. I got the Eero. Eero didn't work. At least it didn't work for me. And my Wi-Fi router died as I was trying to get some work done before I went to my training. So I had to hurry. Of course, naturally, you know, like all geeks, I had two spare shrink-wrapped Wi-Fi routers.
Of course.
Ready to go. Don't we all? And so I unwrapped it, and I plugged it in, and I went through the... I didn't go through the wizard, because I don't trust those wizards. I just did a manual setup. And it worked fine, except for one thing. Even though I changed the default password, it wouldn't change. Well, let me rephrase that. So you know how most modern Wi-Fi routers has a 2.4 gigahertz and 5 gigahertz SSID. So the password for the 2.4 gigahertz SSID changed as I, you know, instructed and expected. The 5 gigahertz one has the SSID, not SSID, has the password that's written at the bottom of the router. Yeah, so I'm kind of using, I might unwrap my other shrink wrap or try the Eero again. I should also note, you know, the Eero used to have an annual or monthly fee associated with it. Since Amazon bought it, it no longer does. So it's just, you know, like other routers, except it's a giant pain to set up since you have to have a phone. I'm not sure what happens if you don't have a cell phone. But
we are just so not the user base anymore for things. Because you and I, like when you said you don't trust the wizard, I don't trust wizards either. I don't know why I don't trust wizards, but...
some of them are evil.
I just don't. Yeah, I guess some of them are evil, and I get very worried about that. So, yeah, we're just grumpy old men when it comes to how we set up our equipment. Yeah. And man, it shows. We are, you know, just give me a good web interface. Hell, if you can give me a Telnet interface, I'll be fine with that.
I'd be okay with that.
I don't need anything. I don't need these wizards and their dark magic coming up and doing stuff. Just, you know. Yeah.
Hey, I remember
weird about that.
I remember setting up Cisco switches and things from, you know, their iOS, Cisco iOS, not Apple iOS, command line, you know, so command lines are fine too. But in any case, which I think we did Telnet into, come to think of it. With no password probably back then. Okay. Catching up on something. So last couple of podcasts, I've mentioned that my Samsung Chromebook Plus, unlike every other USB-C device I have, will not charge on a really nice NecTech 60-watt USB-C charger. And then I think a week or two ago, I mentioned that the Hutu 7-in-1 hub that I have could charge the Chromebook if I put it in between the NecTech USB charger and the Chromebook. And I put a USB-C, not a voltmeter, it's just a power meter. So it does amps, watts, you know, voltage, all that, so you can see what's going on. And sure enough, it just was not passing through what you would think it should be passed through if I plugged it directly into the NecTech or any other. I'm not blaming NecTech. Nothing works on this thing. Not even Samsung's own travel adapter. So, I should try that. I should plug that into that. But anyway, I got a new Anchor. I think I mentioned last week, just before the podcast, I received my new Anchor 7-in-1 or 9-in-1 hub. And I put that, and which has a PD port, power delivery port, USB-C power delivery port. So I plug that into the Samsung, and that works. So I now have a solution that will power everything I have in the house that has a USB-C interface. So I'm a lot happier, because I was afraid that if my charger ever died for my Samsung Chromebook Plus, I wouldn't be able to charge it anymore because, like I said, I could slow charge it, I guess, but I couldn't charge it while using it. Anywho. Something John probably doesn't care about is, but I found it interesting, is Google has apparently released 3 new experimental apps. I don't know what that means, alpha, beta, something. Anyway, Android Police is calling them 3 new experimental apps to help cut down on your phone usage. You know, for people who believe that using the phone too much is unhealthy. Of course, John and I deny that completely. You know, that said, I just got a report that my average screen time was up last week, so I don't care. But anyway, so I gotta go click on this because I don't even know how to explain this one. So there's something, again, this is from Google, right? This is not what's the word I'm looking for without being nasty about it. Somebody with far out ideas that, you know, a fringe developer. It's not a fringe developer. So Google Envelope only works with the 3A. Doesn't work with the 2, doesn't work with the new 4. Doesn't work with the 3, just a 3A, according to Android Police. And it's an experimental app which temporarily transforms your phone into a simpler, calmer device to help you break away from the digital world. So you print out the PDF that's part of the app, and you fold it into the shape of an envelope, and you put your phone inside of it, which only shows you the dialer and the camera. And then you put it in do not disturb mode or something. I don't know. Anyway, it just seems stupid. Basically, it prints out an envelope for you to put your Pixel 3a phone in. Okay, so that was stupid. Next one is less stupid.
Sounds like it.
But last one. Again, this is from Google. It's not from a fringe developer. Next one is called Activity Bubbles. And what you do is every time it unlocks your phone, the wallpaper creates a bubble. And the longer you're on the phone, the bigger the bubble. And the bubbles collect. And once you lock your phone, the bubble stops growing, so the size gets fixed. And then the next time you do it, another bubble. And so at the end of the day, you have a wallpaper with a bunch of bubbles on your screen. And it kind of gives you an idea of, you know, how many times you... Well, it doesn't, not an idea. It tells you how many times you used it, number of bubbles, number of times you used it. and an idea of how much you used it. The bigger the bubble, the more you used it. I found this kind of interesting, except it doesn't, I don't think it allows me to use my current wallpaper as a background. So it's only the bubbles. So interesting, not going to use it. And the third one, again, it knocks out my preferred or, you know, personal screen. It's called Screen Stopwatch. So let me read this again. It's a live wallpaper, okay? Displays phone usage in real time in big, huge letters on your screen, giving you a precise count on how much time you spend on your phone each day. So it's kind of like that iOS screen usage notification that you might have heard being on my MacBook. Interesting idea. I don't want to see it all day. Oh, and every time you unlock it, you get a constant ticking reminder from your home screen to encourage you to put it down and do something productive. Okay, Dr. Westfall. As a psychologist, what do you think? I think it's interesting, but mostly dumb.
Well, so I believe that there are definite uses to knowing more about your own behavior. So if you do not know how often you are spending on your phone, probably only if you are noticing issues with that sort of thing. So if you have, you know, people saying to you, hey, you're on your phone a lot, or, this and that, then I would think that would be a good thing to know more about your own behaviors. However, it's one of those things where, if you really are having that big of an issue, your phone is probably not the only impulse control problem you have. So I would probably think about, you know, increasing mindfulness, increasing patience, doing other things that may have a bigger impact on your life. And the phone problem will likely get better with that sort of thing. So, but yeah, it is very interesting. These sorts of apps and, you know, display or screen time, you know, I always find that interesting when I get the little notification once a week about, you know, what I'm doing. But I don't necessarily think that that I need that sort of control in my life. I've never set up any of the, limitations and those sorts of things. So it's interesting. Google must have paid someone that really cared a lot about impulse control to put these things together. But I don't necessarily think they're needed for most people. Of course, I know a lot of people that tell me that they don't get credit cards because they know they can't control themselves.
Interesting.
So if you know that about yourself, that's a good thing to avoid if you know you can't be trusted.
Yeah, if it's something that literally borders on a disabling behavior, I agree.
Yeah. But for most people, we look at this and go, okay, I'll install something else now.
But there is something to be said about, you know, actually talking to human beings face-to-face and not looking at your phone while you're talking to them. You know, this. I hope this doesn't come off as super sexist because it was. It is. But it was considered kind of like a joke many, many decades ago. So if you look at really old movies like 1940s and 1950s, And it was typically a beautiful actress talking to some, you know, hapless male and says, hey, buddy, my eye's up here. These days, that has a different meaning because we're not looking at our phones. So anyway, sorry for that bit of sexist humor, but it was at the time considered funny, even before my time.
Well, and it's definitely, you're right, it is a very different connotation today, one that both genders can use that same line. You know, my eyes are up here. Pay more attention to what I'm saying versus your phone. Yeah. And I do see this as a problem. You know, I understand people with impulse control issues, and I also understand from watching my students that it is very, very tempting to just, you know, zone out for a moment, to look down and
look, I'm really doing right now.
Yeah, it was funny. I did happen to glance over and see you doing that. But you know, to each their own. I guess maybe there's some people out there that this is going to be useful for. I don't particularly find it useful. But I'm also, you know, I feel like I'm fine about the world. I tend to get things done. and people don't get mad at me too often for being distracted.
There you go. I do, I like you, actually read my screen time and kind of go, you know, I'm using less, I'm using more, and kind of thinking about it. And I have called out people, mostly people walking a sidewalk who's almost a run up to me, and I'll just call it, hey, heads up,
you know? Yeah.
Because mostly to avoid injury.
Yeah.
You know, to either me or the other person. Especially the other person's bigger than me. You know, like, let's please don't collide with me. I might get hurt. Yeah. All righty. Next up was another interesting one. Is that I just read about on LinkedIn, actually. One of my my acquaintances posted it. And this is a Microsoft proof of concept. It's just a website, just a page. Connectivity.office.com. And it's an Office 365 network onboarding tool. It requires Edge for the advanced test, so I haven't run it yet because I haven't run Windows since I read about it. But I did go to the webpage on my Chromebook, and it gives you some, you know, basic things like, you know, is your network connectivity sufficient to run Office 365? And, you know, it seemed very funny to me because, it, you know, it used to be Office never required any kind of network connectivity. It was nice if you had it, and it was almost novel when we started getting network features in Office like Clipart downloads. I remember I thought that was pretty exciting when that happened. But now, you know, if you have Office 365, you pretty much need to be on all the time. You can use it offline, but it doesn't work it well. So anyway, connectivity.office.com. If you're having some Office 365 problems you think might be network related, got to use Edge. That's a problem. And if you're on a Mac and use Office 365, I guess you're out of luck. I'm not sure if the new Chromium Edge, Chromium-based Edge browser from Microsoft supports it, because I don't use Chromium Chromium-based Edge on my Mac. I'm not even sure if it's, I guess it's still beta, so I don't want to install it.
Yeah, and it's interesting to me that Office does need network now, but I use a lot of the network capabilities in Office quite a bit more than I ever thought I would.
Yeah,
online, you know, getting Creative Commons licensed content for slides, and the AI-assisted layouts that PowerPoint has, where you can, you know, make your slides look a lot nicer than I usually have time to do manually. So there are some nice features that I think make it reasonable to use Office in an online mode.
You know, and I will modify one of my statements earlier about not liking wizards. I do like the PowerPoint AI wizard to prettify your slide deck. It works surprisingly well.
Yeah.
I was shocked when I tried it a while
back. You know, Microsoft, maybe they can make a wizard. They can't name things, but you got to be good at something. They're a very, you know, expensive stock, so they have to be good at something or another.
Okay. Next, you know, I'm not much of a game player. The games I do play are the casual ones, generally speaking. And I was never a Tetris fan. Not that I don't like it. I just never got into it. But if you are, apparently EA's Tetris mobile games, Tetris 2011, Tetris Blitz, and Tetris Premium, are all going to stop working this year on April 21st. This is not an April Fool's joke plus 20.
Kind of annoyed by that, because I've owned one of those since it came out. And I don't play it all that often, but I liked being able to download and play it.
Yeah, well, at any rate, I got this from SiliconEra.com, and apparently the EA has released some new Tetris titles for iOS and Android. So, you know, I guess, John, you're going to have to play until it dies, kind of like me and Sid Meier's Civilization and my iPad, you know, which no longer works on 64-bit iPad OS, and pick up the new ones. Okay, the next one.
Only problem that I will point out with the new ones.
Yeah.
You knew this was coming, but I just went to look at them, and in-app purchases. At least the one in-app purchase is a disable ads for $4.99. So okay. I guess if that's a one-time thing, I'm okay with it.
Yeah.
But, do I hate in-app purchases on games. I just want my game. I'll pay money for my game. Do not make me hate the game because you've monetized it so aggressively.
Right. And speaking of in-app purchases, I ran across a really confusing one. You know, John has been talking to me a lot about journaling and his efforts to journal. And so I've looked at the ones he uses, and it's not that I don't like the apps he's recommended. It's just that I haven't done any journaling. Oops, I gotta open the door. I'll let John talk for a bit. John, why don't you talk about some of the
Yeah, so how do I journal? So the things that Todd has mentioned, I enjoy using an Excel spreadsheet to do the pixel a day, where I basically make a 1 to 5 rating each day and get to see how my year is by looking at the end of the year. And I use Day One, which is a journaling app for iOS and macOS. It incorporates a lot of good features, including multiple journals that you can have, different tagging support, geotagging support. It'll capture, you know, your activity that day when you go to make your journal entry. It'll capture whatever music you're listening to while you're journaling, if you like to know about that sort of thing. So those are the two big ways that I journal on a mostly regular basis. I started a year ago with the Pixel a Day, and now I've been also making sure that I write at least two sentence or so journal entry a day. Some days are longer, some days are shorter. But yeah, that's what I've been up to.
Well, so I read about this new journaling app from, it's either pronounced Moleskine or Moleskine. I've heard it pronounced both ways. And it's free with, again, in-app purchases, you know, the thing John and I kind of hate. And the reason I'm interested in it is because it actually doesn't have great ratings. It's 12 ratings, 3.5 average. Their other app, Moleskine Flow, was the iPad app of the year. I didn't buy that either. It's a kind of a doodling app, but it has an annual price, in-app price, and I didn't want to do that either. But at any rate, you know, I've had some Moleskine or Moleskine paper pads and really liked them. They're high quality, blah, blah, blah. You know, people love them, not just me. But this one does, you know, just a whole bunch of stuff. It lets you attach photos and text, of course. And I think you can even do some like quick diagramming. It looks kind of interesting, but the in-app purchasing just doesn't make sense. And I can't even find info about what they mean on Moleskine's website itself for the product. So it has an annual plan at $40 or a monthly plan at $5. Okay, that's straightforward. I get that. What I don't get is this Journey Premium Annual Welcome for $30 and Journey Premium Annual Flash for $20. There is no description about what this stuff is, either on the App Store, Apple's App Store, or like I said, on Moleskine.com. So I'm kind of tempted to try it. I guess maybe I can download the free one and see what I can do with the free one. But I don't know. I wish people would be very clear of what their in-app pricing means, especially if it's an annual one that, recurring costs. Mm-hmm. Am I paying $40 or $70? You know what I mean? Is the annual plan literally just for like Journey Standard? And then if you want more features, you got to pay another $30 a year or $20 a year. So it's really, you know, if it's $20 a year, let's say it's $60 and not $40, that kind of stuff. So, well, I might try it. I'm going to try
and find out. I mean, was the whole thing for me with journaling, was finding the right way to do it. And Day One, so the whole reason why I use two apps now is I've owned Day One since 2014. Mm-hmm. And I really enjoyed it, but I would never remember to actually go write anything in it. Now, when I started last January doing a pixel a day, that at least gave me a moment in my day where I went, huh, maybe I should write something. And so by March, I had done that, you know, 65, 70 days. I thought, I can write at least a sentence about what happened today. And so then I started doing, you know, pop over to Day One and use Day One for a couple of minutes and do that little update. So, you know, if it gets you into it, you never know. You might start with Moleskine, Skeen, Skine, Skeeny, whatever. You might then decide that something else works, or you might just use a Word document or whatever. The point is, get the habit formed, and then you've got, because I've really enjoyed over the last year now having more rich memories about what I've been doing. And it was all starting with just at 9 o'clock every night making myself make a 1 to 5 rating. And go for that.
Okay, so I might try it. I will. Okay, next up. Let's see. Next up, let's see if I missed anything that I wanted to talk about. Nope, I think I got everything. John?
Okay, I've got a few things this week. The first, I wanted to give an update. So back in episode 296,
okay.
I mentioned that there was really, it's really hard to find desktop apps for budgeting and money management. You know, Mint.com is kind of the one everyone gets forced into using because it's versatile and it's owned by Intuit, and they, you know, made their name with Quicken and then they sold off Quicken. You could go buy Quicken again if you really wanted to, and there's a bunch of other little things. But I eventually, about 3 years ago, 4 years ago, I started playing with a piece of software called iBank at the time, and then now they've renamed themselves to Banktivity. And I used them for a little bit. They were a little buggy. The download, the data downloads weren't consistent, that sort of thing. So I stopped using them. And then back when we recorded 296, last June or so, I started using Banktivity again. And so I've been using it for about a half a year, a little over a half a year now. And I've actually been pretty impressed. They've got a pretty rock solid product these days. They're on version 7, so it better be rock solid. But version 6 was a little buggy at times. The data downloads are correct. It'll keep track of stock prices and portfolios and net worth and all that other geeky stuff you might want to know from time to time. And the only downside really is that it's still a little pricey. It's about $50 a year for the subscription that gets you the online data access. If you don't want that, if maybe you don't have a lot of transactions that often, you don't mind entering them all manually, you can still, you don't have to get the online subscription. And there are one-time fees for the applications. Although I did see Banktivity in one of the Mac bundles that a company was selling recently. So if you bought that bundle, you got it for something like 90% off because it, you know, was on in the bundle price.
So
but the Mac OS and iOS apps are also pay per each, which are about $9 to $20 each, I think.
So the apps themselves aren't too expensive. It's a subscription that hits you. So for $50 a year, it's access to data online that includes literally your banks and other, you know, money vehicles. And does it also let you pay bills and stuff the other direction?
It does have a bill pay feature. I've just never used it. Okay. But if you are used to doing like app based bill pay, believe you still can do it. Whenever I've done bill pay, I usually just set up auto debit or something like that.
Okay. And you feel it's worth $50 a year? Are you paying for that?
I am, and you know, I feel it's worth it in the sense that I like having that knowledge at my fingertips, and I like having it. Well, you know, when it comes to your finance stuff, having to have an internet connection is sort of frustrating to view that. So if you're using mint.com, yes, you can download regularly, and yes, you can keep offline copies of basically a giant CSV file of transactions. But there's something about I'm just, you know, I have no network access. I've got my MacBook, and I just want to check something real quick about, you know, how much money, especially things when you're learning about your own finances. You know, we talked about learning about your own screen time and those sorts of things. Sometimes I want to be able to know how much do I usually spend a year at this particular place or at this particular, you know, time of the year, that sort of thing. And in the era of buying things, you know, bundling things to pay once a year to get a cheaper price,
right?
You know, there's a lot of things now that you can do that with that you couldn't do in the past. So I think about, you know, my car insurance. I pay that twice a year.
Right.
It can be real easy to forget that's coming up this month. You know, you need a more complex budgeting app for that than just set aside X number of dollars a month for that. You want to know what month that's going to come pulling out. So for me, I like having that ability. I could see for a lot of people it's overkill. Obviously, I can't really talk it up to my students because they're poor college students and they're just lucky if they have a bank account. Honestly, but if you've got a little more, if you've got some money and you want to make sure it's doing something productive because you are fortunate enough to have enough to do something productive, I think you want a solution that's not just web-based.
It's funny you say that, you know, because I remember when I was a poor college student, I actually did track stuff so I wouldn't run out of money. So actually it was really important. It was most important back then, you know, like could I eat? But later on, when I was about your age, which is many years ago now, but when I was about your age, I became again, in, you know, sort of really interested in not just how much I was spending, but you know what I was spending on, and categorizing and doing some analysis. And I think it might be an age thing. I think right around your age now, people get like, you know, I really need to understand this much better than I did before. So I can see how that happened.
Yeah, so I think it's a good thing to have the options to do. And also, one thing to mention is that if you don't have a specific money need, there aren't a lot of services out there for you. So, you know, a lot of the services that do exist that are Web 2.0 type services, other than Mint, are, you know, focused on budgets, or they're focused on investing, or they're focused on paying down debt, or they're focused on a little, you know, window into your money needs, but they're not your actual big picture. Right. So this is more of a big picture app versus a specific app.
Right. Okay. And I guess you've been busy this week.
Yeah. I also have a couple of blog posts that I put up this week. So one of the blog posts on johnwestfall.com is focused on basically using Microsoft Power Automate or Flow to send out a reminder to people who have booked an appointment with you about where you are and when. I talked about that a little bit a few weeks ago. So that's fully written up now, and I've got screenshots of what the flow looks like in Power Automate. So that's one of the blog posts I put up. Another is using Microsoft Excel in the classroom. You're the kind of person that needs to track when students are participating in a discussion, and you think, God, that's going to take forever because, you know, I have a 75-minute class Monday or Tuesdays and Thursday mornings, and I could sit there with a notebook and write down, you know, so-and-so said this or so-and-so said that. That takes a lot of time, and I would become very distracted trying to keep track of that. Excel, I can type the first couple of letters of the student's name. It auto-populates the rest of the name because it's already seen that name in the last 100 or so entries. And also then I can just make a rating of 1, 2, or 3. I also in that particular class have students presenting, so I need a way to track when they are presenting on their topics and have little rubrics so that they can get feedback on what they did well and what they didn't cover. And so I've got another table in that same workbook that is for that purpose, for tracking those things. And then finally, I found a really cool thing in Excel that I had never played with called the indirect function.
Never heard of it.
Okay, so here was my problem. I need to produce a rubric report for each one of my students so that they get customized feedback.
Okay.
I obviously keep all of their scores in a spreadsheet. So I need to basically, if you're a database person, I need to take a table and move it to a record so that it just shows one particular row. The problem is, in Excel, if I want to do that, I can link things from one page to another page, but I don't have an easy way to do a record controller unless I actually use VBA forms or something like that. So what I actually found was that there's a way to pipe the contents of a field or a cell into a formula. So in this case, we all know that if I want to reference, you know, C2, I just put equals C2. Well, what if I want that number, 2, 3, 4, 5, whatever, to be in another cell? So that as soon as I update that cell, all of the cells that reference C2 are now referencing C3 or C4 or C5. And you can actually do that through the indirect tag. So if you download the example workbook off of my blog post, you'll actually see how this looks, and it basically gives you a poor man's record sorter feature, not sorter, but a record seek sort of feature without needing VBA or anything like that. You just simply say, okay, I want to create the report for student on line 57. You type 57 in, it populates everything you need, and you take a screenshot of the report and send it off to the student.
So
I was very happy with that one.
So just to clarify for myself, so, you know, they often say, they being, you know, teachers and professors, that participation is part of your grade. So is this part of their grade? I mean, their participation? So if you've literally quantified participation.
Yes, I literally have. As I'm sitting there, I tell them that they get a score for every time they participate. They get a score out of three. One is okay, you just basically said, yeah, I agree.
Right.
Yeah, you participated, but that's not great. A two is, you know, you have something substantial, and it was really good, and I liked it. And a three is, wow, you really gave this some deep thought. You linked it to some of the other things we talked about, or you shared something from outside the class. You know, a three is a really good piece of interaction that you're giving to us. And I can usually make that assessment as I'm listening to it. So if I was doing this in a notebook, it would literally just be student's name. One, student's name, two, student's name, one, et cetera, et cetera. But this lets me do it. And I can actually then tell students, look, you've participated four times in the last 2 weeks. Right. This has been your average participation score, and that sort of thing.
Yeah. So does that help them self-correct, or maybe not self-correct?
That's what I'm hoping. I'm entering these scores in the online learning management system every 2 weeks so that they can sort of see how their average is doing. And they can self-correct, and they can always come talk to me and find out. And I've got some that talk a lot. You know, I've already gotten 2 weeks, certain people that are up to 14, 15 times they've talked in class. Right. And then I've got some that don't talk hardly at all.
Right.
So that's why the pivot table that I made for this tells me not only what your average score is, but how often are you talking? And I do a standard deviation calculation so that if I want to, I can do a correction of some sort so that, you know, if you talk a lot, your average is, you know, as just as useful as if you don't talk that much at all.
So, you know, and this is in no way a comment on your students, more a comment on you. When you started explaining this and I started looking at your blog post, I kept thinking about, you know, since you are a psychologist sitting in front of either a live test animal or a video with multiple clickers and clicking on, you know, the pertinent behaviors that they're studying. This is before we had computers and things that could really do all this stuff. And you know, so if the animal goes to the feeder, that's a click. If the animal raises his head towards the sound, it's a click. That's what came to mind when you started explaining this.
Yeah, it's very similar. And as a psychologist, I like to know that what I am asking students to do is, I will actually give them credit for it. So that's how it works. But yeah, definitely. Even if you're not in education, I would definitely take a look at the example rubric report page that I put together just so you can see that indirect statement, because I had never seen that in Excel before, and it now is really changing the way I think about building workbooks so that they are useful not just for recording data, but also displaying data in ways I can share with other people. And in this case, what I'm just basically going to do is take a screenshot, but you could also copy and paste and that sort of thing. So,
yep. Any rate, johnwestfall.com, WESTFALL. John is JON. John.
Yes. Westfall.
No H.
It's an unnecessary letter I don't need.
Well, you know, people always take the last D off my name. My name has two D's at the end. And they always take the last D off, and I have to. Generally, I don't correct people unless it's something important that needs a correct spelling. But when I was a teenager, maybe in college, I got really annoyed at one point by this, because, you know, as you do when you're a teenager, almost everything annoys you. And I seriously considered changing my legal name to be spelled with two T's and two D's just to really mess people up. You know, say, oh, hey, you spelled my name wrong. Oh, two D's? Yes, and also two T's. The first one's silent. But, first one's silent, second D is silent. It's just
there's important. A silent R in my name somewhere. Figure out where it is.
But at any rate, okay, John, thank you as usual. We had, you know, I didn't know what we were going to talk about 12 hours ago, so this went pretty darn well. And we will talk to you next time.